Welcome to Emerging Experts. I'm your host, Jordan Zava. In this episode, we delve into the cutting-edge intersection of artificial intelligence and cancer research. Join us as we speak with Zoe Zan, a third-year hematology oncology fellow at UC San Diego, and Akshat Singhal, a postdoctoral scholar. They share their groundbreaking research focused on leveraging the power of deep learning models to predict palbociclib response in patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. Would you start by introducing yourselves to our audience?
Of course, I will go first. So my full name is Zoe Zan, and I am currently a third-year hematology oncology fellow at the University of California, San Diego. I am going to start my junior faculty position in breast medical oncology this fall. And breast cancer is something that I have really fallen in love with throughout both my research as well as clinical experiences that I can go into a little more in detail as we go along this discussion. But very excited to be here today.
Hi, my name is Akshat Singhal, and I'm a postdoctoral scholar at University of California, San Diego. I'm working with Dr. Trey Heidecker on developing AI models for precision oncology. I recently completed my PhD in computer science. And yeah, I like to, my goal is to develop these models that are interpretable so that we can understand what's happening and then better predict patient response and improve treatment.
Perfect. Thank you both so much for joining us today. And just to kick off the conversation, would you mind just introducing what got you into pursuing a career in oncology?
Of course. So I, like I mentioned, have fallen in love with oncology first through the basic science realm. I back in medical school at Duke University, had this wonderful opportunity to do a basic science study on looking at the impact of aerobic physical activity on the tumor microenvironment in mice models of triple negative breast cancer, and specifically looking at the impact of a modifiable risk factor like exercise on immune environment in these animal models of triple negative breast cancer. So that was through a Howard Hughes research fellowship. And I would say that breast cancer is such a heterogeneous disease. There are so many different layers to therapy, and also even to not just the treatment of disease, but all the kind of risk factors we can modify for patients, both in active treatment, in the survivorship phase. And so when I came through fellowship, I had the opportunity to see patients in clinic and really merge my scientific interests with my clinical interests. And then the fact that I'm here today with Akshat really also spoke to some additional and really exciting directions I have been able to participate in as a clinical fellow. Precision oncology is increasingly important in breast cancer care. No two patients with even the same receptor statuses are alike in tumor biology. And I think this is why I have really been excited to understand and also take part in our study of looking at deep learning, looking at machine learning in optimizing precision medicine in breast cancer care. So that was a mouthful, but I think we just have so much that we are still trying to optimize for our patients. And this is one of the exciting aspects of breast cancer care today. And part of why I chose this direction for myself.
Cool. So I am a software developer by profession, or I was at least. I did my 4 years of industry work, and I came back to academia because I wanted to work on projects that more directly impact human lives. And the first project was actually just introduced to me by my PhD advisor. But I think the genetics aspect of cancer, the way machine learning can be applied, or actually the tools that I'm good at can be applied to cancer research. And I think all the collaborations we have had with people, especially at Moores, I've talked to so many oncologists there, and they are really generous in explaining the ways we can improve treatment care or patient care is something that made me just continue research in this area.
I love that. That's so interesting. Thank you both so much for sharing. And what inspired this specific research into machine learning to predict palbociclib response in ER positive HER2 negative breast cancer?
Maybe I'll start in this question. Yeah, so initially so the goal of our initial project was to develop these deep learning models that can directly identify the genetic markers of treatment resistance or response. And then when we were working on projects, initially I was not aware of the research area very well, but then when we were training our models, the palbociclib model turned out to be pretty well performing, honestly. And so we started investigating more, and then we tried applying it on patient data, and we got some good results. And then we were very fortunate to meet Dr. Kay Young and Dr. Zoe Zhang and Dr. Barbara Parker. All of these oncologists then told us so many things about how we can make this research m much more, not just impactful, but patient driven or treatment driven, or actual treatment driven, and not just a research project. And so I think that's how we started and have continuing work on palbociclib research. I think Zoe will be able to tell better about why palbociclib research itself is super critical in oncology or breast cancer.
Yeah, thank you, Akshat. So, I mean, when I joined this project, the translational science, the development of the model itself was already ongoing, and so I was fortunate to join when I did. But I think speaking to the clinical inspiration for developing these machine learning models for therapy prediction, like CDK4/6 inhibitors. Such as palbociclib, which is the first CDK4/6 inhibitor to be FDA approved. The reason is that while this class of therapy is approved by the FDA in the first line treatment setting for estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative, advanced or metastatic breast cancers, there are still critical clinical gaps in this areas. So when we look at phase three studies of CDK4/6 inhibitors combined with endocrine therapy, the overall response rates hover around 50%, more or less, when you look across different trials. And also, we know that some patients have primary resistance to this therapy class, and then others who do respond eventually will develop resistance. And so to this day, we don't have a great biomarker that predicts who are the subset of patients that respond versus don't respond. We have mechanistic explanations of resistance. We have preclinical studies to kind of help support the understanding of response and resistance mechanisms. But again, ultimately in clinic right now, if a person comes in with this diagnosis of ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer, that is advanced or metastatic, we give everybody more or less a combination of frontline CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy with endocrine therapy. So I think we know that a biomarker or a systems biology based kind of predictive model would help us in the future once we get enough both retrospective and prospective study to support its efficacy, would have a great potential to help guide clinicians in assessing treatment decision for the patient. And then also there is this emerging field of when we are considering someone who progressed on CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy in the first line setting, what's next? And what's next is right now dependent on the presence or absence of select biomarkers. So for patients who don't have those select actionable biomarkers, once again, we don't have a great answer. One approach is to use sequential CDK4/6 inhibitor therapy, but the benefit is mixed when we look at studies, and we think that when we have a better biomarker, we should be, in theory, able to better select patients who derive greater benefit versus those who may not. So I think these clinical gaps are at the core of the inspiration for these model developments as well.
Definitely. Thank you both so much for the background. And what can you guys tell me about this machine learning model and the data used to train it?
Right. So at its core, it's a standard feed-forward deep learning neural network. The model has the input of the model are gene alterations, so mutations and copy number amplifications and deletions. And it's the input is very simple. It's binary. If there is a mutation in a gene, it's one, otherwise it's zero. I think the USP, or like the universal selling point of the model, is its architecture. So we are a systems biology lab, and what we do is we develop these data-driven hierarchical networks or graphs, which are like tree-like structures. And what they represent is the cellular organization of any cell in our body, including cancer cell. So what that does is it allows us to understand the pathways that are more important for drug response. And so we train our model architecture, the neural network architecture, using these tree-like structures, which is interesting because neural networks themselves are arranged in a tree-like structure. And so they overlap, or they you can imagine a projection that works very well. And then it simplifies how a model is trained, or I should say, the model is biologically informed, right? Each neuron represents some biological entity. And then when we evaluate the model, we can directly assess what's happening. The data, as I mentioned, is gene alterations. For training, we use publicly available cancer cell lines. These are available through resources like CCLE or COSMIC from Broad and Sanger. And then for validation, we make sure that we evaluate the models on patient data. So far we have patient data and PDX data sets as well. So far we have evaluated the palbociclib model on a patient data cohort from AACR Genie, PDX cohort. And right now we are working on a project where we are collecting, or we have collected patient information from Moores Cancer Center. And these are 139 patients with genomic profiles available. And the outcome measurements were done by Dr. Zoe Zhang and her group. And so we have this very rich and accurate outcome information that allows us to precisely analyze the model.
Yeah, so I think that is definitely something I can add on. So Like Akshat mentioned, there's a robust training process for this model in the preclinical setting using cell lines as well as patient-derived xenograft data to show that this machine learning model for palbociclib was predictive and accurately so for differences in outcomes. For the cell lines, we were looking at drug response, basically looking at area under the curve analysis and seeing that resistant cell lines had a much higher odds ratio for viability compared to sensitive cell lines that were therefore sensitive and therefore getting very efficient cell kill from palbociclib. That's sort of what we want to see when we are hoping that we have an accurate model. And similarly, the PDX, the patient-derived xenograft models showed that a statistically significant difference as well in the resistant versus sensitive groups. But of course, at the end of the day, we want to see how this pans out in patients. So that is why we did this retrospective analysis of patients that were treated in our institution, UCSD, that had re received palbociclib. We included patients that had received palbociclib in any line setting because we wanted to use real world data and we wanted to have enough sample size in our for our data analysis. So we included patients that were treated at any time points between 2016, which is when palbo was FDA approved, to 2023, which is when we conducted the study and had our analyses initially done for this retrospective study that had tissue-based NGS profiling, so that can be then given to Akshat and his lab for prediction using the model because the NGS profiles are the input. And so I think I might be jumping ahead a little bit to some questions you might have coming up, but in short, our model successfully identified patients who had a durable response to palbociclib, which is both when looking at treatment duration and overall survival. So patients who were predicted to be sensitive for palbociclib had a statistically longer duration of therapy on palbociclib at 31 months versus about 15 months for those who were re predicted resistant. So the sensitive patients had derived longer benefit, in short, from palbociclib. And when we look, and that was, as I mentioned, with statistical significance. And when we looked at overall survival, we see as well that the patients who were predicted to be sensitive by the model had a statistically longer overall survival at about 59 months compared to that the group of patients who were predicted to be resistant about 31 months. And so these are, of course, still early efforts, but this was very, very promising for our model validation and supportive of what was already looked at in the preclinical setting.
That's perfect. Thank you so much. And then just going off of the findings, because that was excellent. And that was my next question anyway. How does this model improve upon traditional methods for predicting drug response?
Traditionally, the models were more statistical, linear models that would identify a gene signature, so like a mutation panel or gene panel, and would just assess the response of any drug on a small set of patients or preclinical data and would give a simplistic analysis of what are the genetic factors. Then came, I guess, about 8, 10 years ago, these high throughput drug screens that had much larger data sets. And at the same time, incidentally, we had machine learning advancing very rapidly. So then came this explosion of machine learning models. So what people did, they took machine learning models like random forest or even deep learning models to just train on the entire data sets for 1,000 cell lines, 1,000 drugs, you know, so that makes us a million data points, right? And you would put everything in a model and try to understand or try to just improve the prediction or predictive performance without being able to clearly say, you know, what's happening underneath, right? And we call these models black boxes. So it's like a, you know, a magical box that does something without us knowing what's happening. And so, yeah, that was, I think, the traditional version. And so we took a slightly different approach. We did pick the best in class method, deep learning, but we, as I mentioned before, we made it interpretable so that we can understand the pathways, the signaling pathways, and all of those, and the processes that are causing a particular response. Because, so even though, what, let's, you know, just take an example of palbociclib. So it is a targeted drug and it's supposed to inhibit CDK4 and CDK6. But what happens is there was this previous study done that told us about 97% of the drugs have off-target effects. So something else always happens in, you know, in addition to what we wanted to happen. And so that's what we wanted to know. Why is a patient, as you know, Zoe mentioned initially, no two patients have, you know, same response. So even if we think they would respond similarly, but they don't, so we want to know what's happening. And that's what we added. We are, our models, I would say, are simpler because it's like one model for one drug, which is a deviation from how the whole field of AI works. The field of AI is about like bigger and better. We wanted to be more precise and, you know, so we have this one model that can tell us, I think, with a pretty good precision that what's causing a particular response.
And I'll give the sort of my potential, perhaps simplified clinician's view on this, which is that I think right now, just to take it back a step, we don't have an integrated model yet for predicting drug response to CDK4/6 inhibitors. I think that's the kind of the fundamental states of things right now, but there's a lot of interest in developing and also validating such a model so that that can be incorporated into clinical practice. Because, like I said, CDK4/6 inhibitors with endocrine therapy are approved first-line therapies sort of across the board. And of course that I don't mean to imply that the model will necessarily change this high, like very like robust body of literature that supports this frontline use. But in the second line setting, when someone progresses on CDK4/6 inhibitors, again, like it's right now really driven by the presence or absence of individual mutations that have targets. For example, mutation in the estrogen receptor, which we call an ESR1 mutation, or mutation in the PI3 kinase AKT pathway. Outside of these actionable mutations for which there are drugs, patients who are wild type in these particular genes don't have great single kind of clear choices of therapy for sequential line therapies. We might use as a switch a CDK4/6 inhibitor from what they got on the first line to a second line, different one. But we are not seeing, even when there is benefit, the benefit is modest. So I think that's how a model, any model that would put increase the and optimize the selection of patients for appropriate therapy. But specifically, this AI model, I think from a clinician standpoint, is a visible neural network. So like Akshat was saying, and the visibility of the model is what gives me hope and excitement, because I'm not just putting giving like an NGS profile as an input and blindly trusting the output that, oh, this patient have a tumor that's sensitive versus resistant, but the structure of the model is visible, and we can go back into that structure to interpret what pathways are altered that might be driving the resistance, and we can even perform kind of confirmatory biological studies to show not, and the impact of novel biomarkers. So I think those are two of the crucial benefits to this VNN model compared to traditional methods, and also in a space where really in clinical practice there is not yet a model, period.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you both so much for that answer. And how do you think, for our community oncology audience, how can oncologists without a background in machine learning interpret and use these tools effectively? And how do you think oncologists can stay informed when learning about the advances in machine learning?
I think so th there's a really this these are really good questions. I think the good thing is that machine learning is increasingly important and present in oncology care. I think right now where we see more of this might be at least from my experience looking at like detection, screening, using imaging kind of based data as as sort of a methodology for machine learning and prediction, and then even immunohistochemistry analyses for kind of guiding diagnostic workup. I think real to me at least, and from what I've seen in this field, the integration of therapy kind of guiding models or machine learning technologies is still very much in the investigational stage, as we have highlighted even with our model. But there's increasing presence of research efforts being presented at big international oncology clinical conferences. For example, there was a really, really interesting presentation on looking at a combined clinical and genomic model that's for predicting CDK4/6 inhibitor response, actually, at San Antonio, one of the general sessions done by a research group out of Memorial Sloan Kettering on their patient cohort. So I think there's recognition of its importance, but ultimately to integrate use of such models in clinic, this is an effort we're taking as well. We need to generate a understandable, interpretable report for the clinician. So, and there is still a gap there that we are working on, as well as many groups, I believe, for their respective kind of machine learning tools, is how do we use all this big data and then the generated response, and then and present it in an understandable, streamlined way to a clinician who's just pulling up a report. And I think having that type of report is ultimately what can be useful for clinicians. So our vision for this report, for instance, with our model, would be to show the palbociclib VNN's predicted response, sensitive versus resistant. But beyond that, for each individual patient, to show the top genomic contributors to that response, whether that's mutations in key pathway genes like the retinoblastoma gene, or in the cyclin-dependent kinase complexes that's directly involved in the signaling, or TP53 mutations, like to then therefore have a correlated molecular profile, and then potential therapies that are, further match to these genomic alterations. So it's a vision that we have for the future, but hopefully with all the efforts, that's something in the near future.
I don't have much to add. That was a great answer. I would say in general, for oncologists to just be more be more hands-on, these tools is getting much easier these days. You have a lot of code writing tools that can help you develop the models themselves without knowing a lot of coding, or almost any coding these days. It's becoming that easy, right? And I think in just a few more months that will improve greatly, so that it becomes a fun project to try and just have become much more, I think, in tune with how a machine learning model works, and not see it as some magical boxes does something without knowing. Like, just play around with it and you'll see how it's working. In terms of, as Zoe said, our tools, we are making very conscious effort to make it much more streamlined and how oncologists can use our tools. We're also working on more software pipelines that can then be installed in, hospitals or clinical care. That will very much simplify how a model works. And so essentially, an oncologist would not need to really run the model themselves, but just provide patient information, and then they'll get this detailed report of what's happening, or why is a model making such a prediction?
I agree completely with what Akshat said. I think ultimately, I think there needs to be a trust in the model, which of course comes from data to show it's efficacious. But I think a clinician's mind will think about biologically what is going on, and to trust this machine learning model, I think they need to have some sort of glean some sort of understanding of the biology of the disease from the model, not just blindly trust in the result, even if that result has been demonstrated to be a accurate prediction based on previous, research. So I think therefore visibility is very important, and explainability is very important. At least that's how I would kind of personally feel comfortable using such models. And I think there is also this, and I think it's ultimately important still, despite how the machine learning might advance oncology care, to keep in mind that clinicians ultimately need to interpret that result and integrate it with everything else they know about their patient. So if I have a patient, I'm not going to only depend on the model's prediction, but I will consider the model's prediction and also consider the patient's comorbidities, patient direct, like other kind of patients' performance status and patient preferences as well, and integrate that into a clinical decision for the patient. And I think these are going to be exciting challenges, but also opportunities for us in the clinical oncology kind of world.
Yeah, please feel free to reach out if you have any questions in anything related.
I think what I would say the key takeaway is are that there are important clinical gaps that even in what seems to be well-established practices that exist. So when we think about, for example, in this kind of frontline or second-line therapy setting with a very widely used class of medicines, to think about the nuances of where gaps are. So who, for example, who develops resistance, who might benefit from sequential treatment, and with CDK4/6 inhibitors, and if a adaptive approach with a clinical tool that, like such as the CDK4/6 inhibitor response prediction model, can guide a more selective decision making for patients. These are really important questions that I think machine learning tools are aiming to answer, and then also perhaps to also shift the field over time away from dependence or over reliance on single mutations, because really it's a biological network of proteins that are genes that code for proteins that interact with one another. So there is strength to be had or derived from understanding kind of the network of interactions that drive a oncological response or lack thereof. So I think that is one key point. I think it's still recognizing the fact that this is an exciting space, but I would say still very much and Akshat might disagree, but maybe like still an emerging space in the clinical kind of integration of machine learning, especially for guiding therapy decision making. But I think that speaks to the work that still needs to be done. And I think for everyone to, especially clinicians, to perhaps have a little bit of an open mind when considering how in the future we can all benefit from having kind of supplementary tools like machine learning tools for clinical care.
For more updates on the latest news and trends in oncology, be sure to visit www.targetedonc.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. You can also find us across social media platforms. Follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Targeted Onc, and on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Targeted Oncology. See you next time!